This is Rose Combs, and I'm trying to do my podcast. And I've been trying to do this all day and make it sound good. Some of you people will probably wish I had stuck to writing. For anyone who may be interested, my maiden name was Gasaway, but that was a very long time ago. And to start out with, I was born in 1952 in Mesa, Arizona, and ROP or RLF, whichever you prefer. My childhood was spent in the Tempe area, and my family during the first few years of my life were members of the Foundation for Blind Children here in Phoenix. They were charter members of that organization. And one of the things that the foundation did do in their first years was go to the legislature and make it possible for blind children to attend the public schools. Before 1957, any blind child or visually impaired child was basically sent to Tucson, whether the family wanted that or not. And in 1957, that law changed, and they started having children going into the public schools with resource teachers and all of the attendant stuff. My parents were young, very young, and but they encouraged me to learn things. I know my mom spent quite a lot of time when I was little teaching me how to chew. She says that she ate an awful lot of celery and stuff to get the idea of chewing across to me and making me feel her face and stuff. I don't remember that, but she still tells the story. And my dad was real different about things. He always thought that I was going to have to get along in this world no matter what happened, and he was not one to think that every eye doctor had the cure for me. My mother took me to every doctor in the Phoenix area, I think, with the expectation that somebody was going to say that something could be done. I don't think my dad ever really went for much of that, but he never really said either way, but just based on the way he treated me most of the time, I don't think he did. When I was probably 2 or 3 years old, I can remember vaguely of playing with his tools and him teaching me how to use things like screwdrivers and wrenches, showing me what they were used for, allowing me to take things apart and put them back together, encouraging me to do it correctly. My parents divorced when I was 4. My dad went off into the service when I was around 5, and I was living with my grandparents. But when Dad was home, he always seemed to have some sort of a rundown car to get around in that didn't work real good. And I usually was encouraged to come out and help him fix it. Now, I don't really think I did all that much in those years to really help fix. But I did sort of learn about engines and things of that kind. Not that I don't think he ever expected that I was going to be a mechanic or anything, but it was still good. But when I got even older, I could help him do things like change spark plugs and change the oil and stuff like that without a problem. And it's more than some of my stepsisters ever did. Well, anyway, when I started school in first grade in 1958, I was the second class to go into the public schools. And the first year, my first grade year, I was in the Scottsdale school system because that was really close to where the foundation was. And then in second grade, I was a little closer to home in Tempe. And in third grade, I got moved even closer to my dad's house. He'd remarried by then, and I was living with him and my stepmother and 2 stepsisters. And I did pretty well those first 3 years of school, and had a fairly normal life, played with the neighborhood kids, and got into trouble, and got out of trouble, and, you know, did the typical things. I never really learned to ride a bike. My younger stepsister got a bike at one point, and we rode it together, And my dad talked about getting a tandem or building a tandem. I think he was more inclined to build one than to buy one. And but it never happened. It was one of those things that he talked about, and it just never, probably because when I was 9 years old, he and my mother had some sort of a dispute, and I wasn't actually living with him anymore. There are times that I wonder if that was one of the biggest mistakes in my life, but it might not have been, I don't know. But anyway, when I was in fourth grade, I lived at my mom's and my stepdad's, and they didn't have any kids in their neighborhood, and I wouldn't have brought any of them home anyway, because my stepfather was an alcoholic, and I never knew what kind of mood he was going to be in when he was home. I went to school in the fourth grade here that year, in Tempe still, and my mom switched jobs, and her days off became the same days as my stepfather's, and they liked to go fishing and camping and hunting and stuff. And so they had a couple of choices. Really, they had a third choice, but they never took that one. The third choice was that they could have left me at my dad's and let me go on attending school and pick me up when they were done with what they were doing. But it didn't work that way. What they did was either take me to my aunt's, who lived way out on the west side of the valley, about 50 miles or more from our house, and leave me for usually Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, pick me up on Friday, or they took me with them. The upshot is that during the last half of my fourth grade year, I attended school on Mondays, sometimes on Fridays, once in a while on Tuesdays, and maybe once every 6 weeks for a full week. Obviously, that didn't do a whole lot for the learning process. Now, whenever I went to my aunt and stuff, I always had books with me, and I studied and read and stuff, but it just wasn't the same. And the school didn't look at it the same either. So, during the summer of 1962, my mom decided that I should go to the state school for the blind in Tucson, which did happen in September of 1962, and to nobody's surprise, including my own, I took the fourth grade over again. When I was sent to school, I really felt that that was a big rejection by all of my family. I didn't understand a lot of things, but I was sort of mad at my dad for not stopping it, and I was mad at my mom because I knew in my heart that she didn't really want me at home, that she wanted her freedom to do whatever she wanted to all week long and not have to worry about whether she had to take me to my aunt's or take me with her or whatever. My mom has always said it was for my education, and I know that a good part of the reason probably was for my education, but even this many years later, I still have some ambivalent feelings toward her for the way the whole thing was handled. Needless to say, my first year at the school was rather rocky. I did well enough academically, but I had a hard time adjusting. I only got to come home once a month, and on holidays like Thanksgiving and Christmas. And generally, I stayed at my mom's. Once in a very great while, they'd let me go stay at dad's, but it was very seldom. And so I just assumed that he didn't care what was happening to me. And so I stopped telling him hardly anything about my life. And we drew very far apart because I just didn't understand that he really was not in a position to have much say about what was going on in my life at that point. Well, when I was in sixth grade, I had a very excellent teacher, a man that I think probably I had a big crush on. One thing is very obvious. I wanted to please him. I wanted to do things that would make him tell me that I was a worthwhile person. And so I really picked up on everything. I worked a lot harder on my academics, and I participated more in outside activities. I had less of a tendency to want to go off by myself and sort of mope, which I had done before, and got really involved in extracurricular and things to get noticed, to get him to say, hey, you're really doing good, or you've really improved this year, or, you know, something like that. So that was probably a good thing. And he was a very interesting teacher. He did a lot of interesting things in class to make learning a lot more fun than I had known it to be for a long time. And that pretty much got me started on the track that I continued throughout the rest of my education at the school. I was always very much involved in almost everything. If there was a party, I was generally on the committee to do the baking, or help decorate, or make plans for whatever games, you know, and I was the one to help create the haunted houses and all that kind of stuff. I was always kind of in the middle of everything. And actually, for a totally blind person, that was doing pretty good. I was just there, and I didn't believe there were many things that I couldn't do. I knew I wasn't going to drive a car or fly a plane or something, but I didn't have a lot of inhibitions about not being able to cook or sew or whatever needed to be done. And so I won some home economics awards, and I did some talent show type stuff with the chorus and with music. I played piano, and I'd always wanted to play piano. The only thing that I never mastered was Braille music. We had a teacher who insisted on it for my first couple of years in Tucson, and I got really bored because I could play better than I could read. And when that teacher adopted a child and left us, and we got a teacher who didn't know Braille music at all and didn't necessarily insist, I pretty much dropped it and didn't spend much time with it after that. So I don't play much anymore, and I've never really gotten the hang of Braille music. When I was a senior, I had some mixed feelings about being a senior. I was really tickled to death to be involved as much as I was in everything, and it was really great to know that I was in the top class and that I was a good student and looked up to by the younger children and respected by the teachers and stuff like that. But another part of my mind was sort of hung up on, once I walk out these doors in June, I've basically lost home. I've basically lost my support system, the people who have been around me, house parents, teachers, students, friends, that I've had for 9 years. When I walk out in June, I won't have these people anymore, and that's really kind of hard to deal with. And you don't necessarily have that when you leave your parents' home, because you know you can go back, you know you can visit. It was kind of difficult. But I graduated in June of 71 and flew to Little Rock to do the summer college prep program that they did then. At the Arkansas Enterprises for the Blind. And I was there for 9 weeks. And the first day I was there, I think everybody assumed that I was going to be one of these really quiet, shy, mousy people. The reason is that I walked in to a meeting after I'd arrived only an hour or so earlier, and some big man walked up, stood next to me, and said, okay, we're having this meeting, we're getting acquainted, and the very first thing is we're doing a state by state, tell us something about your state, and you're in Arizona, so you're first. And I couldn't talk. I couldn't say anything. I didn't know who the guy was. I didn't know where I was. I was totally off balance. and it was like I just lost my voice. So they finally had, they said, oh, well, we told everybody about this morning in the meeting that we had before lunch. And somebody said, she wasn't here before lunch. So they let me go last. By the time I got to be last, I managed to say a few words about Arizona, but I was still pretty much shook. And I'm not the best of public speakers, as you will be able to tell on this tape. So I spent the 9 weeks there. I got along with everybody reasonably well. I made friends. I knew just about everybody on the campus. I was friendly to most, maybe not so friendly to some. I don't have too many specific memories of the place, except that I had never been to any place where there was no breeze before. And walking out in the mornings to go to breakfast or going to lunch or doing something and being outside and not feeling any breeze at all, the first few days, it was very oppressive and depressing for me. By the time I left, I was pretty much used to that and kind of liked some of the things that were going on there and didn't like others. But I was only there for 9 weeks, and I thought, oh, well, this was easy now. I could go to college and be fine. Well, I went to a small college in southeastern Arizona that had dormitories and was far, far from home, and I had reasons for doing that. There were a lot of family conflicts between my two families, and everybody wanted me in the middle, and I felt that since I hadn't really been a part of those families except for an occasional weekend or summertime, that I really didn't want to get involved in the problems. And so I chose to go to a school that was at least a 4-hour drive from home and had dormitories. I knew I didn't want to go to one of the community colleges in this area because I didn't want to be forced to live at either home. And it was not the best thing I could have done for myself. There was no other blind student there. I didn't know one person. And from my experiences from Little Rock, I thought I was going to be just fine. And within weeks, I was doing well academically, but not so well socially. I was used to being part of the crowd, part of the middle, group. I was used to participating and putting things together and planning things. And suddenly, here I am at a college where I don't know that many people. Well, within a few weeks, I knew a few, but every time I wanted to help with anything, they always said there was nothing I could do. And it was really difficult to deal with things where I was constantly being told, oh, there's nothing you can do right now. Just sit down and watch us do it, I didn't do any actual dating while I was at Cochise. I didn't do too much socially other than to go to church. And I made some friends, but they weren't the kind of friends that understood some of where I had been and what was going on. I couldn't just walk up to them and say, geez, it feels really terrible when you get lost, because they didn't understand getting lost. Well, anyway, Valentine's Day of 1972, I was sitting in my room feeling really dejected, and I finally just kind of said, what am I doing here and why? And what do I do about it? And I decided then that I was going to apply to go to Arizona State, where I knew at least three people who were already there, and including my best friend and roommate from high school. And I came home on spring break in March, and I filled out all the paperwork and was accepted at ASU and finished up my second semester at Cochise, glad to know that I wouldn't be going back. I didn't really think I'd miss anybody. Most of my friends were actually sophomores while we were friends, and they were going to be gone anyway. And they kept telling me it was too bad I wasn't making friends with the freshmen, but I just wasn't into some of the things the freshmen girls wanted to do. So I was really glad to get to ASU, and it was much easier for me because I knew at least, well, by the time the summer was over, I knew several blind people who were going there, in addition to other friends that I made. And I had people that I could talk to occasionally if things were wrong. And despite the family problems, I could call my parents if I needed to, either one of them. And so that was better for me. And then we hit the spring of 1974 when it seemed like, to me, emotionally, things were totally out of control. And I had some issues to deal with that I probably would have handled differently under different circumstances, but I was too emotionally involved in too many family issues and stuff to really fight back for what I thought was right. The long shot of it was that I was pushed into considering a major in sociology, which I really didn't want. And that summer, I felt like I really had to find a way to support myself. And I knew it wasn't going to be easy without the college degree, but I had to prove to myself that I could do it. And so I took a job that was offered by the state to work in a program preparing some visually impaired adults who had a lot of other problems to possibly be able to work in a sheltered workshop situation. None of them were going to be living on their own. None of them would ever be capable of living on their own with their disabilities in addition to being blind. Some of these were mental, emotional, and physical problems that would mean that they were always going to need some help. And I worked in that program for about a year. It was trying times. I discovered that I really, really don't like working with people who are slow learners. I did my very best and I was very patient, and there were people who said they learned a lot, but I found it very frustrating to work with people who were really, if I could tell them a couple of times and they got it, that was great, but it didn't happen very often. It was usually you went over and over and over, and I just didn't handle that well. My husband and I got married in May of 75, and in June of 75 they terminated those job positions due to budget cuts. And although I was a little bit hurt, and we did definitely need the money I could have made, I was not really, really unhappy about that situation because I knew I didn't want to stay in that job for the rest of my life. Within 2 weeks, I was enrolled in a medical transcription course at a local school, and also I was enrolled in the Hadley School course that used to be available, and I was taking them both concurrently. In probably March of 76, I was considered ready to start looking for jobs, and I started sending out resumes and letters of introduction and that kind of thing. And the state took me on a couple of interviews, and one of them they did in the summer of 76 was to the county hospital, and I've always classified this as the interview from hell. However, it was also the interview I learned a lot from. When I went to the interview, the VR counselor went with me, which it was one of the very few interviews that he actually was with me. Usually I went on my own, but he set this up and he insisted that he would pick me and another girl up and he would take us and be with us, blah, blah, blah. When they started asking me questions and I started trying to give them the solutions I would use, he over-talked me and started telling them different things. I didn't get a much chance to present my own problem-solving ability. One of the things that came out of the interview, though, was that a tool available to me was the Opticon. And my ears definitely perked up for that one. they took me out finally and gave me a typing test, and they they had this dictaphone. Well, it was not a dictaphone. It was an IBM belt machine. I had never seen one before. I couldn't figure out the first little bit how to back it up. The typewriter was an old IBM, and it was old. And when you'd start typing on it, some of the keys would fly off of the keyboard, and you'd have to catch them and put them back on. And I didn't do exceptionally well on the test, although they did invite me to come back and take a civil service exam, but I didn't do it. And when I went back in after the typing test, they had more questions, and we talked for quite some time. Actually, the counselor and the head of the department talked for quite some time. I very seldom got to say two words. And I left feeling very, very down. And I got home, and I sat down, and I decided to write down the questions that she asked, as many of them as I could remember, and to put down my solutions to those problems, and to commit it to memory, basically, because I knew that I was going to encounter similar. And I also created my own list of questions of things that I'd like to ask about a prospective employer, because it's a two-way street. And I didn't get to go on any other really job interviews at that point. Just a few weeks after that interview, the hospital that my husband worked at and close to our apartment called me, because I had already been there earlier and put an application in and talked to two people and been in contact with personnel and the director of medical records and stuff, and asked me if I was willing to work on call for 3 to 4 weeks. I said, of course I was. So I went in and I started. And then when that stint was up, I went back to the school and I picked up a few things that I had some problems with on the job that I needed to get straightened out in my own mind, and asked some questions and stuff. And then they called me back and they said, we have a maternity leave that starts the 1st of October. Can you do it if it's nights? And I said, yes. I really didn't want to work nights, but I wasn't going to tell them that. And I said, but I have this opportunity to go get the Opticon, and I will be scheduled to go for that in the first part of November, and I do need to take those 2 weeks off. And they said, okay. So I went in and started working. After that interview from county, I called the state and I said, definitely interested in the Opticon. I want the interview that tests whether you can use one or not. The VR counselor I had started to hedge and tell me that there were reasons why it couldn't be done, and I had worked for the state, so I knew who was where. I called the supervisor and said, this is what he said, this is what I need. It was set up, and I went in November of 1976 to Palo Alto for Opticon training and returned and got my Opticon, and found that it helped me a lot in work as far as looking up words and stuff. But at that time, they didn't have the typewriter attachment for the Selectric typewriters. So I had a hard time reading what I was typing. It was difficult, and it was even more difficult because I was working night shift from, you know, like 3 in the afternoon till midnight. And I am a morning person when it comes to getting things done. But I held on. A couple of times I didn't know if I was going to make it. I didn't know if I could pull the type of stuff we had to do it's not a hard thing to type, it's not a hard thing to listen to the doctors, but when you're not getting feedback, it's harder. And we were on Magcart typewriters, which were kind of strange machines in themselves. Well, then The maternity leave ended, and they called me back a couple of weeks later and said they had a full-time position available for me if I was interested. Of course, I was interested. That was in January of 1977, and I've been there ever since. I did do, from late 1977 till early 1979, I worked part-time for quite a lot of the time. It was set up that way on purpose. I was getting just too exhausted trying to type perfectly and not make a mistake and getting no feedback really from what I was doing unless I rolled the paper up and down and then not always getting it completely aligned the way it needed to be, etc., etc. And I was also finding there were things I didn't know, like brand names on over-the-counter drugs and stuff. One of the solutions to that was my husband and I would go to the drugstore and carry a tape recorder, and he would read off the names and spell them for me off some of the products. We'd walk up and down the aisles. He'd pick up something, spell it, and the tape recorder, tell me what it was, put it back. And the point I'm saying here is that as a blind person, you're going to have to do more than most to get a job and stay in it. You can't just go to work on Monday morning and come home on Friday night and totally forget the job when you're home. There's other things you're going to have to do. It's just a given. Well, in 1979, I got the attachment for my Opticon that fit on the Selectric typewriters. I had asked the state when they told me it was going to be available about buying this attachment. They had asked me to submit a budget, which I did, and in which I had approximately 67 cents left over to buy shampoo at the end of the month. And they told me that I made too much money for them to help me. Well, it's true that we had just bought a house, and maybe we should have stayed renting, but I wasn't paying that much more in house payments than I did renting, so I wasn't so sure about that, but it's the last time that I asked for anything from the state. It's the last time I ever approached them for one thing. After that, I went to the credit union at the hospital, got an account, applied for the loan, got it, and bought the lens when it became available in 1979. I went back to full-time work 3 weeks after I put that lens on my typewriter. And that's where I've been ever since. Now, I've done other jobs since then. I worked for other doctors from my home as part-time jobs. I did a cardiologist from 1986 to about 1992 when he got someone in his office who could actually do the typing. And then I worked for a service type person in 1990, late 92, 93, for a while, doing a lot of plastic surgery, orthopedic surgery reports, basically hands and arms and stuff. And then in 1994, I went to work for another cardiologist, and I worked for him for about 2.5 years. And he moved his office clear across town from me, and we were having some logistical problems, and we came to a very amicable agreement to terminate my services with him. I was making really good money working for him, and that was the one part of it I hated to give up. But I didn't think I could handle too many more 20-hour days and stuff. So, you know, it had its good and its bad, and we had ways of handling all of that. In 1984, the hospital went into word processing in October, and I got my start a little earlier. I don't know if this is the time to give you my whole computer history or not. Let's just say that I had a computer here at the time with WordStar, and it was a CPM-based operating system. And I had learned WordStar during the summer by doing a couple of projects for my mom and doing some stuff for my husband and having my husband read me the book I could have done it with the Opticon, but he's a little faster. Not much, but a little. And so we did that. And when they brought the things in 1984, I had a CRT lens for the Opticon, and it was just great. I mean, that I had access to the computer at all was amazing to me. And I used that Opticon lens, and I was doing relatively well. I already had the basics of word processing. The only thing I had to learn was the different terminologies, because WordStar and WordPerfect called things slightly different names to mean the same thing, but you know, it's just like Word does now. And so I was off and running. In 1985, as a matter of fact, my supervisor was unwell for several weeks and was only in the office part-time, and we had three people starting, and I was aware that we had no training materials set up. And so one evening, while my husband watched a baseball World Series game, I sat down at my K-Pro and I typed up a step-by-step training manual that basically took the person from the moment they walked in the door and logged into the computer until the last thing when they logged out of the computer at night. We were using Data General with slave type situation and WordPerfect 3.0, and I wrote the manual at home on WordStar. And that amazed everybody. I couldn't understand why they were so amazed, because it was all in my head and it was really easy for me to step through the whole process of creating the template for the report or the getting the demographic information for the report and doing the things that we were supposed to do. And I didn't understand why they thought it was so amazing that I wrote it in WordStar. But anyway, I took it in and gave it to my boss, and I said, I don't know if you can use this or not, but if you can, it's my contribution to training. 2 years later, when they upgraded WordPerfect to 4.2, she came back to me and asked me if I could change the manual to reflect all the changes in the program. And I did that, and they used that manual until we stopped using the Data Generals in the spring of 1991. So that was a good feeling, to know that I could write something that people could use and learn from and do the job by using it without a whole lot of someone hanging over them, telling them every step of the way and getting in their way, basically. And so that was kind of nice. In 1991, the hospital went with a product called MedWord. It was awful. Didn't have search and replace. You could only block about 15 lines at a time. I nearly quit my job over this product. I was still using the Opticon, although at home I'd been using speech for a number of years and been trying to push for it at the hospital. They really didn't want to spend any money, so they didn't do it at that time. And I got through the next 3 years, but I wasn't very productive. MedWord was just not friendly. In any sense of the word, to someone using an Opticon. You know, you get a report and you try replacing right with left all through four or five pages with no search and replace, and doing it all using an Opticon, that's very time consuming. And I felt during that 3 year period, I basically felt depressed most of the time. And it's probably why I went ahead and worked for the lady with the service and did the orthopedic stuff at home for as long as I did. Because at least there I felt like they needed me more than the hospital did. And my reviews were not the best. They weren't awful, awful, but they weren't good. And I was really, really having a hard time. In 1994... the hospital started talking about going back to a product that would use WordPerfect, and I got in gear and insisted that they were going to have to put speech in my computer. And my boss kept telling me no. And then I went on vacation, and I came back, and they had done some remodeling in the office. And my monitor, which had always been sitting flat on the desk, was sitting up on this monitor arm that, when I sat down in my chair, the top of the monitor was over the top of my head. And when I pressed on it with the CRT lens, the monitor went sliding back to the wall. And basically, my choices were to stand up and read and sit down and type. And 2 days of it, and I flipped my lid. It's one of the few times that I got up and yelled at my boss, thought I was going to get fired. And when I didn't get fired, I wrote a letter to her boss, stating what my situation was and how I thought they could help me improve my work for the hospital, and bringing up the speech and definitely getting rid of that monitor arm. And I came in a couple days later and that arm was gone and the monitor was back down on my desk where I could at least reach it. And a couple of days later they came to me and they said, "We've decided that you will get some speech products with your computer. Now you have to tell us what you want. And you have to put it in a written form." And, whoa, I hadn't really determined exactly what I wanted at that point. I hadn't really thought I was going to get it. So I went home. That was on a Friday. I went home that Friday afternoon. I was part of Genie Information Services thing. I logged on and started downloading every demo speech program we had in the library. And hooked up my old Echo because I had SoftBird on my computer with its proprietary speech synthesizer that didn't work with anything else. And so I hooked up the old Echo and started playing with speech program demos. And the two that I came up with at the top of my list were ASAP and Focalize. I knew more people using ASAP. I also knew that I would have a great support system for ASAP on Genie. And I didn't know that about Window Eyes. And when I played with Window Eyes, it hadn't been quite as intuitive to me as ASAP. So I bought ASAP and a double talk synthesizer, had them put on my computer here at home. Actually, I did that myself. And my husband put the synthesizer in. I don't mess with the insides of computers. It's not that I couldn't, I just choose not to. And I started using ASAP and I was functioning very well in it within the first afternoon after the demo thing. And then I took some of the other programs and put them back on and tried them with the double talk. And I still wanted ASAP. So I wrote up a proposal for ASAP and the double talk with information in the document concerning some of the other options available and why I was choosing what I was choosing. They bought it and they installed it in September of 94. We started learning the new programs in late September. I had a lot of trouble at first with the demographic screens that we had to work through. Once I got that figured out, and that was not with the help of the trainers, that was with my coworkers helping me. I had one trainer who walked up to my screen and said, "It's in that blue box," and she drew pencil marks all over my screen, which cracked up all the people who worked with me. And anyway, within 5 weeks, I had doubled my production using speech. I had gone from doing approximately 700 lines a day to doing 1,400 lines a day. It wasn't the top of the crowd in the office. There were people who could do a lot more, but it was a definite improvement in a very short time. I used ASAP and in DOS and stuff until 1999, and I had planned to use ASAW as my Windows program. However, we all know what happened there, in one sense of the word, and it broke my heart. I really hated to give it up, but I knew if it wasn't going to work in Word and stuff, that it wasn't going to work with all the convoluted stuff we had to do on our networks and stuff like that. And so, Thanksgiving weekend of 1998, just before Thanksgiving, my boss told me that the company we worked with SoftMid, had said that they had people using their Windows product using JAWS. And my boss told me that and wondered if I could find out anything more about it. And I said, oh yeah. So I went to the JAWS site then. I downloaded the latest demo on Thanksgiving weekend. I put it on my computer and I started right off reading the manual and playing around with the program. And at the end of that weekend, I ordered my own copy the following Monday morning. And I went to my boss and I said, yes, this is probably going to work really well. It's doing great in Word and doing great with email. And it's doing things on the internet. And she said, well, we don't have internet yet. I said, but we will. Remember, that's the long-range plan. Transcription will have it. And she goes, well, that's true. And so I started learning JAWS, and I've never really looked back. The only thing that I had a real hard time with at first in JAWS was the keypad. I kept doing ASHP and ASAW commands on the keypad, and it didn't work the same way. And it took me probably about 4 months to quit doing some of those. And so in 1999, we went to Word and Windows. They never trained me. I have done all my own computer training. I have never taken a real computer class from anywhere. I've never had a personal trainer. I've never spent time with a computer professional doing the training, unless you count my husband. During the spring of 1998, they had been talking about programs, and I knew that I wasn't getting ASAW to work in Word, and I knew people who were using Window or Vocalize and Windowize slightly, and so I thought that's where I was going to go. And I never actually got the software installed on my computer, but I downloaded one of the Assist with the from Iowa. They used to be able to download them free. The program that I did was Word with Windowize, whatever the version was, which was way back in 98, so who knows. But I had it on my computer, and I was using it somewhat with ASAW and using ASAW commands instead of Windowize commands. But Word didn't work well with that, and Dennis told me it wasn't going to. And so when I got JAWS and I went back to learning Word, once it was definite we were going for it at the end of the summer, I just used the same manual and converted keystrokes as I needed to. And why I didn't go back and get the JAWS one is, I don't know. I guess I like to do things the hard way. But it wasn't that hard for me. I just learned it. So when they came in and started asking how they were going to accommodate me for the Windows and Word classes they were teaching at the hospital, one of the people from IS came in and started asking me questions, and I was answering them with all these keystrokes and how to do things, and I was telling them things they didn't know because they're so mouse dependent. And so when it came right down to it, they said, you're the only one who does not have to take Windows or Word training. There is no point in you taking Windows or Word training. So I didn't take the training. And within the first week after we got the new system set up in Windows, I was doing fairly well, except that we had a memory problem on my computer, and they had to change out the memory. And until they did that, I had to reboot about 15 times a day. And that means you're not real productive. And finally, after about a week, they realized that something was wrong and that I wasn't getting the full memory usage that I was supposed to have. And that's where I am right now. And we're supposed to be changing platforms again. It still is going to be Word-based, and it's still going to be a Windows thing. But exactly how it's going to work with JAWS, I don't know. My boss has said that she's been told it works, but we don't really know what that means. There has been no actual demonstration. I've had no hands-on for any of this. And I don't expect to. Until it's there, and we're forced to use it. Hopefully, I will do just fine. I have, as I said, I've done my own computer training throughout my life. I've learned several speech programs. I used the old KTalker program with the K-Pro. I didn't particularly hang to it and stuff, but I knew how to use it. And I switched to video voice for when I first got my first PC at home, that, you know, PC clone, basically. And I used that until it seemed that it was no longer supported. And then I went to the SoftVert, which was probably a big mistake, but I was already on the TSI mailing list, and it looked good at the time. The big mistake is not so much the program itself as the fact that the synthesizer was so proprietary and getting things done. If SoftVert didn't work, I didn't have a choice but to keep on using it anyway, and stuff. And then I went to ASAP, ASAW, and now JAWS. I've played with WindowEyes a little bit, but I'm not a power user by any sense of the word. I'm lucky if I can get my speech rates to stay the same for any one session. And I've only played with a demo of that. I haven't really played with a full-blown program. I haven't wanted to spend the money since I don't seem to use it really well. I probably could learn it if I would just sit down and do it, but I haven't had a reason to, really. As far as doing medical transcription work these days, currently, you have a lot of things available as a blind MT, but you're going to have some problems. First of all, what you have available are the Stedman word books and the dictionary and the quick look drug book and stuff. That's really great that it's on CD and that it's accessible with JAWS. Now, I can't speak for WindowEyes because I've never tried to do this. As a matter of fact, I personally can't speak for any of these programs at all because I haven't been able to use them at work because of our network. But everybody on SightlessMT at yahoogroups.com says that they work wonderfully with JAWS. And that goes for students and trained professionals alike. I just haven't had much experience with them because I can't load anything on the computer at work. The way their network is set up, they won't let me. I've been asking, and I keep asking about those CDs, and they say I sound like a broken record some days. And I just figure maybe someday they'll actually hear me and I'll get them. But at this point, that's not an option for me. The training is a lot different now than when I took it, of course. When I took it, I went to a local school and it had the school course, which is no longer available. But now you have things like the Kathy Melton course at case.com, I think it is. She teaches an online course. I know she's using the iVocalize client. Just exactly what her structure is, I do not know. But it would be easy to find out. And she teaches a course. I don't know exactly what materials she even uses for the course now. But if anyone was interested, they could find out easy enough. I know that a couple of the other schools, like the Andrews School, offers correspondence courses, and they send out a lot of their stuff in CD, and they've been really good with the visually impaired students who have taken their courses. Of course, I haven't taken any transcription courses in 30 years, practically, so I don't really know personally how that works. Some of the other things I use on the job, one of the things I use daily is my Braille note. I use it to take notes. I also use it to store a lot of information. I have scanned in a couple of medical word books and such where I can use it to search for words in a book and stuff like that. I keep everything on my Braille note. You just wouldn't believe the numbers of books I have on my little 5 gigabyte card. I have anything from the current romance novels that I pick up off Bookshare or Web Braille to books on terminology, books on anatomy and physiology, medical word books. I have books on using Word and on using Windows and all kinds of stuff that sometimes I need them. Sometimes it may be 6 or 8 months that I don't even look at the Word book, and then something comes up and I need that book and it's right there. I just flip to that part of the Braille note, open it up, and I can search and be right where I want to be in a matter of a couple of minutes. So that's one of the things I use. Other transcriptionists do use Braille displays. Love to have one, but I've never been able to convince them that I need it. I've done fairly well using the speech, and they just don't see the advantage to spending that kind of money for the Braille display. And I have to be careful about Braille displays because I'm a one-handed Braille reader, left-handed. And if they buy me something like an 80-cell display, I'm going to have a hard time reading it from what I've seen. The Braille note could double as a Braille display. I've used it that way at home, not on my new computer because all it has is USB ports and I haven't figured out which one works with the Braille note yet. But I have used it as a display at home. I can find that it would be really useful when you're doing really close proofreading, when you're looking for every single punctuation mark and stuff. But and I could find it to be real useful when you're dealing with the pre-made-up templates that they use for some of the doctors, where you just fill in the blanks here and there. Only problem is the doctors don't stick to the templates, so you get totally lost. And yeah, I could see having a Braille display for that kind of stuff. But I don't think I would use it for every single report every day. It would slow me down. And I am reasonably productive. I run about the middle of where my office stuff does, and I do, you know, approximately on the average of 180 to 185 lines an hour, basically. And so that's kind of in the middle. We have some that do a lot more, and we have some that do a little less. I use the internet a lot because of not being able to have those books on my CDs on my computer. I use Google daily, and if they ever change that site so we can't use it for searching, I will be very unhappy. I know so many of the Google products lately are being leaving us out. I just hope they never change that main site because I use it all the time. And I'm getting really good at finding drug names, and it was really funny one day because I told somebody, I said, yeah, I've been having a really bad day. And they said, what are you doing? I said, I'm looking for drugs on the internet, you know. But it was true. I was trying to find drugs that this patient was on that were not the usual things that I can normally spell. So, and there's a lot of options. I do think that blind people can do the job, given the right training. I do think that anybody interested in this would need to have a reasonably good background in English and would also need to have a good sense of how things work in human anatomy, physiology. You don't necessarily have to take anatomy and physiology courses, but you kind of need to know that the difference between, say, the ilium, I-L-I-U-M, which is part of the hip, and the ilium, I-L-E-U-M, which is part of the stomach. And you basically have to know which one of those you're talking about. There are some other basic sound-alikes that you have to be able to distinguish. And you basically have to have a good grasp of spelling. You don't have to be perfect because you've got spell checkers to help. You should have a reasonably good typing speed. Let's say that you don't want someone coming in who only types 20 words a minute. It's not going to work. But I'm not going to specify a typing speed because that varies so often on the dictator that you have. You do need reasonable hearing. I have a hearing loss on one side due to surgery, and sometimes that does affect the way I hear things. I do have, I've regained a good percentage of the hearing on the left side, not all of it. And occasionally I do have problems with doctors that are speaking very quietly or that there's a lot of background noise when they're dictating, and I can't pull it out where somebody with two good ears could do that. I think you have to have the ability to listen to people and hear what they're saying, or be able to intuit what they're saying, even if you don't understand every syllable. But I do think it's a job that many blind people could do, but I also know that there's not too many places that will consider a blind person for the job. They don't want to spend the extra time or the extra expense of getting the speech software and stuff set up for them. And there are a few companies that will do that, that hire at-home MTs. I have not wanted to go that route. I've worked at the hospital for 29-plus years, and I prefer my benefits package there, my paid time off. And for the most part, I like the people I work with. And so I haven't really wanted to work at home and stuff. I like the package that I have right now, basically. The pay is, you're not going to make three-digit or six-digit income, probably. But you can do reasonably well if you're working full-time and if you're producing what they want you to. You're going to do reasonably well. Well, as I said, I've been married for 30 years last May, and my husband is legally blind, but he sees really well for being legally blind. I'd like to get him to do a career cast sometime soon. Don't know if that will happen. He worked at the hospital long before I did. We met at ASU, though. He was a friend of my roommate's, and that's how we met. And we didn't like each other much at first, but things changed. And he has helped me a lot in my choices of things to do. He's done, you know, like helped me with the business, with the printing, and stuff like that. He always did all of my printing work for the jobs that I did at home. And he did a lot of the technical stuff for the one doctor's office where we were sending stuff over by modem and stuff. He created databases for them and stuff to show, the doctor wanted the database to show the medications that every patient was on. And we'd go through all the reports and set up the database so that he could look at that database at any time and see what he'd put the patient on, when he'd taken them off of it, what other doctor had put the patient on. It was pretty cool. Database that Tom built for them. And he's gone back to school and gotten his bachelor's degree within the last 10 years, and now he's working on his master's degree. And he goofed off a lot in college and says now he wished he hadn't when he was in the first time in the early 1970s. He said he didn't take it seriously at all, and he wished now that he kind of had, that he might be a little farther along in a career than he is now had he taken it more seriously. We ride a tandem bicycle most places within a short distance of home. He sees well enough and feels confident enough to get us where we want to go. We take bike paths when possible. Otherwise, we obey all the traffic laws. You don't catch us running lights or going the wrong way or whatever. Carry lights with us for nighttime travel when we have to do that, or early morning travel going to work. Do our grocery shopping using that bike, and we do back and forth to work. Years ago, we would never think of taking a cab anywhere that wasn't a really long distance, but as we've gotten older and as we've made a little more money and things have changed, we do take cabs. If Tom says he doesn't feel like he wants to ride the bike that morning, I don't argue. We take a cab. Because that means that several things. It means that either he's just really tired, or that he just doesn't feel like he can handle it. And that's about it Well, we also used to bowl. We don't do that anymore. Tom is in sports, and I am more of a book person. I prefer to read. He watches a lot of movies. I watch a few, but he's more the movie person. I'm more the book person. But we get along really well. We help each other out when things are difficult for the other one. I do typing for him or help him figure out. He uses JAWS on his computers just sometimes, and sometimes he can't figure out how to do something with it running because he doesn't use it all the time. And so I have to help him there. And we have different things in the computer that we're interested in. And we have a pet Labrador who is like our child, basically. We don't have any children. That was a decision that we made after we were married for around 6 years, that it just wasn't feasible for a lot of reasons. And I won't go into detail on that. We just don't. And we have Charles, our pet lab. He is a pound puppy, or was. He came from the pound about 4 years ago. And we have had several dogs. Some of the people who might know me from Janie and from a couple of other, the email list know that normally I have a tendency to pick up dogs that have problems. And I've had some emotionally scarred dogs before and got them through it and stuff. Charles doesn't seem to be one of the worst. He did come from the pound. He was 4 years old. He's a lab, and somebody put him in the pound because they said he was too big. And I thought, my gosh, it took you that long to realize a lab was going to be a big dog. It didn't make sense. That's the only thing we know about his past, is that his owner thought he was too big. And he's been pretty good for us. He's 8 years old now, and he still gets very puppyish sometimes. But he's our pet. We don't have a guide dog. I didn't think making one run along beside the bicycle was such a great idea. And Tom wouldn't qualify for one at this point. And there may come a day when I'll change on that. For the most part, if I need to, I use a cane, but because of a hearing loss, I'm not out much on my own without some assistance. I don't care to cross very busy streets. I think based on what I'm hearing now and based on what I gather from riding the bike, that I would be perfectly safe to do so. But I don't really want to take too many chances. And I do sort of miss the independence. I was always a really good cane traveler until I had the ear problems. And I'm still not bad. I just choose not to go places where I have to do a lot of street crossing and stuff on my own. And that is my choice. That's my decision. I go a lot of places with people, and I go with my husband a lot, and my cane is usually available, although I don't always carry it. But we get along just fine. That's about all I want to say right now. I think I've probably talked a little bit too long for this. And if people have questions, they can contact me. I'm going to give only my email address. I don't give out my phone numbers on public places. And so I'm only going to give out my email address, and that is Rose Combs, and it's all one word, no capital letters, Rose Combs, ROSECOMBS, at quest.net, QWEST .net. And that's where anybody can reach me if they have questions or any reason at all that they want to contact me. And with that, I'll say bye.